From the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Those in America are no longer upset when it comes to filling up their gas tank. 2 years ago, the national average for a gallon of gas was around $3.40. It's now about half that. But while American consumers are excited about how cheap gas is, it's quite the opposite for people in countries that rely on exporting oil. The price of a barrel of oil has fallen more than 70% since June of 2014, and some oil exporters are taking action. Just this week, Saudi Arabia, Russia, Venezuela, and Qatar agreed to consider freezing oil production in an attempt to bring prices back up. But that decision may not be enough to head off tough budget decisions in many countries, including cutting thousands of jobs in an attempt to try and cut government spending. On this edition of Global Journalist, a look at the pain in the oil-dependent economies of the Middle East. To start off, we're going to take a look at the Sultanate of Oman, a country of about 4 million people on the Arabian Peninsula. Their oil accounts for half of GDP and 70% of exports. Joining us from the capital, Muscat, is Mayank Singh. He's the group editor of United Media Services, the country's largest media company, and publisher of the Oman Economic Review. Mr. Singh, thanks so much for joining us on Global Journalist.
It's a pleasure.
Tell us, if you would, how are ordinary people in Oman, how do they feel this dramatic drop in oil prices?
Sentiment has been affected for the last few years. I mean, there is a lot of trepidation. But on the ground level, there hasn't been much of a change that we see visibly. The main driver of the economy has been government spending for a number of years, because it's a very oil-dependent economy. 78% of the revenues used to come from oil and gas. And everyone in December was watching what are the signals that the government would give with the budget. But the government has given a very strong and positive message, because despite the drop in oil prices, I mean, the revenue has come down by almost 26% this year, the budgetary estimates, but they haven't cut back the expenditure accordingly. The expenditure has only been reduced by 11%. So that has helped sentiment here. And we haven't seen any visible layoffs, which were expected. There has been a few things, which, like, the fuel prices have been increased. There has been an increase in taxation, but visibly on the ground level, it's been pretty much business as usual as of now, at least till now.
And as with many countries in the Gulf, Oman does have a lot of expatriate workers from South Asia, from India. How are they faring in this?
No, I mean, the government has made it very clear that their main priority is looking after Omanis, first of all, seeing that there are no major layoffs for Omanis. The rationale is that even if expatriates lose their jobs, they can go back to their own countries or other countries and get jobs. So the main effort is to see that the Omanis don't suffer, first of all. If expatriates lose their job, they are fine with it. And we have heard of layoffs happening in the oil and gas industry, particularly for expatriates.
And Oman, it does not have much in the way of industry outside of oil. There's very little agriculture. There's very little manufacturing there. So what are the government's long-term plans to replace this revenue that used to come from $100 a barrel oil?
Oman was one of the first countries who realized that it cannot possibly in the long run rely on oil and gas. So they started something called 2020 Vision in the 1990s, where they wanted to diversify the base of the economy away from hydrocarbons to tourism, manufacturing, and to shipping. Now, that hasn't happened as they had wished for. But now, because, I mean, push has come to shove, there is a heightened sense of urgency to see that the economy diversifies from hydrocarbons. And a number of measures are being taken in that direction. If you look at the papers, almost every day, there are contracts and tenders being signed in the non-hydrocarbon space. So in a way, it's a blessing in disguise. I guess a lot of things that should have been done and which were on slow till now, they have been put on a fast track as of now.
You mentioned earlier that the government was cutting spending about 11% this year. What does the job market look like for young Omanis, for people just finishing schooling, for finishing university? Do they have the same opportunities that people 10 years ago, 20 years ago had?
I mean, it's been a challenge. I mean, if you look at Oman, it's a very young country. Almost 50 to 60% of the population is below the age of 35. So job creation has been an ongoing challenge, and with low oil prices, it's that much of a challenge, much more of a challenge now for the government. Government has come back very heavily on the private sector, saying that The government has absorbed as much as it can. Now, I don't think the government going forward can create as many jobs as it was in the past. It's asking the private sector to step in and help Omanis. They're saying that this is payback time, guys. You need to create more jobs for Omanis going forward. We have helped you. And the other thing is they are expecting more jobs to be created in tourism, in manufacturing, and in shipping, I mean, in ports and logistics. But yes, it's going to be a long haul. It's not going to be easy in the short run.
So in other words, if I'm understanding you correctly, Mr. Singh, what you're saying is part of the government's reaction is to ask the private sector to hire more Omanis. Does that mean also fewer people from South Asia and other countries where expatriate workers come from?
Absolutely, absolutely. What they are looking at is saying that we are going to have more of public-private partnerships. Till now, the government may have been funding a lot of projects themselves. Now they are saying that we are unable to, and we would like more private sector participation. Secondly, as infrastructure projects slow down, there will be a lot of expatriate labor. Most of the laborers in Oman are blue-collar workers who come from countries from Southeast Asia, South Asia. So as and when the infrastructure projects go down, automatically they will be going back to their countries or losing their jobs. But the government is fine with it. They're saying this is a part of the bargain. When the going was good, it was fine. But the main effort is to see that more and more Omanis who are graduating, Oman has almost 60,000 graduates who are coming into the job market every year. The first priority is to say that they get absorbed in the market. But yes, it's going to be difficult. It's a challenge, but the government is working on that.
And with just a few moments left, Mr. Singh, during the Arab Spring in 2011, there were protests in Oman. The government responded by raising minimum wages, by raising payments to some sectors of the population. If the government cuts spending, are we going to see more political unrest or social unrest?
I mean, unlikely this time around. I mean, that was something which was not Oman-specific, but that those were winds of change which were blowing across the region. Since then, there were certain issues which the government, at least Oman, addressed them very well. So after that, we haven't seen. The government has absorbed a lot of youngsters. They have made changes in the education system. So I guess the fundamental issues have been addressed already. So it's very, very unlikely that you would see something similar happening all over again, despite low oil prices.
Mayank Singh, thanks so much for joining us on Global Journalist.
Pleasure. Thank you.
A reminder to our listeners, you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, a look at falling oil prices and how oil producers in the Middle East are coping with the economic shock. To broaden our discussion now, we've got three additional guests. Joining us from London, Georgi Kantchev, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. From Beirut, Reynad Mansour, a fellow with the Carnegie Institute for International Peace. And from Dubai in the United Arab Emirates, Alexander Cornwell, a reporter on oil for Gulf News. Thanks to all of you for coming on the show. Georgi Kantchev, if I could just back us up a little bit here. Can you just remind our listeners what has caused oil prices to decline so much over the past year to year and a half?
Yeah, I think it's been that we have just too much oil. For about 2 years now, prices have been falling, and they've fallen by about 70%. And the reason is simple. There's been ample supplies all around the world, from the US to Russia to the OPEC countries. And in the meantime, demand has fluctuated. In 2014, it was very strong. It was very weak. In 2015, it was very strong. This year is supposed to be weaker again. So we're talking about uneven demand and pretty strong supply. This has created a glut on the market. And in the end, it has raised fears that these low oil prices were going to stay with us for longer than expected.
And Alexander Cornwell with Gulf News, we understand that there was just an agreement this week between Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Russia, and Venezuela to freeze oil production. What is the significance of this? What's the likely impact of this?
Well, at the moment, it's unclear what the impact will be, because if they do freeze production, we're still going to have that glut. It's just that we're not going to have any extra. Now, we have had today and overnight the UAE energy minister come out and say that the UAE supports the production freeze. But we've then also had Iran, another major producer in the Gulf, saying that they're going to keep pressing ahead and adding production. So it's unclear at the moment whether or not it will change anything. However, we should note that today we've seen oil rebound, Brent to $35 a barrel on the back of that news of the production cap.
And Reynad Mansour, tell us if you would, the oil economies are situated differently in the Middle East. Which economies are best situated to ride out a period of low prices? Which ones are most vulnerable?
Well, I think you have to look at the different populations. Definitely some of the smaller Gulf countries that are able to perhaps maintain that state and society social contract without having to resort to raising taxation, for example, or to really feel the needs of a large citizen base, those economies might be able to ride it out. Now, other countries, let's say the bigger ones with a bigger local population, for example, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia particularly, I think they'll have a bit more difficulty and they might have to resort to certain policies, privatization. We hear a lot of that with Saudi Arabia, for example, and having to really reconsider budgets as well.
And Mr. Mansour, you study Iraq, which is in the midst of a war with ISIS, is a very vulnerable country. Tell us about the economic situation right there. How are these low oil prices affecting the lives of people there?
Well, for the last few years, I mean, when the Iraqi parliament has passed the budget halfway through the financial year, they'd have to reconsider it because of the falling oil prices. For example, news came out today that the state, the Abadi, the prime minister of Iraq, has basically decided to cut about, 30% of the budgets of some of the state paramilitary fighters who are meant to fight against the Islamic State. So the state is unable to pay for, if you want to talk about the security situation, many of the fighters who are fighting against the Islamic State. And I think that's perhaps the biggest priority at the moment for the government.
And one other aspect of this, too, that is coming into play, Georgi Kanchev, is the reentry of Iran into the international oil market after the lifting of sanctions there. How is that likely to affect both Iran's internal finances as well as sort of the global market for oil?
It will definitely affect the global market because we're talking about Iran raising production by 500,000 barrels a day and possibly up to 1 million in the longer term. And in the past 2 years, we had a surplus, a daily surplus of about 2 million barrels a day. So if you add 500,000 to that or even 1 million, this definitely is going to increase the pressure on prices. Now, of course, the question is, will Iran, freeze or cap this output in accordance to this deal? And I think the answer here is probably not, because they had lost a lot of market share in the past few years while they had been under sanctions. And now they just want to make this back and, win their old customers, the exporting to Europe, to Asia. So I don't think Iran, which also needs the cash and now can get it because the sanctions are over in January, I think Iran is going to definitely produce a lot more oil, export more oil, and this will add to the glut.
And Alexander Cornwell, just to pick up on what Georgi had been saying about the reentry of Iran into the oil market, one of the interesting dynamics that's happening right now is that two of the largest oil producers, Saudi Arabia and Iran, are basically fighting proxy wars against each other in Yemen and in Syria and Iraq. So the fact that they're also sort of bitter strategic political rivals, how does that affect the oil market and these decisions by producers as to how they will halt or cut supply?
Well, historically, we have often seen oil prices spike when we've seen instability in the Middle East. But recently, that hasn't happened because of the glut. And while there is definitely a political overtone to the oil crisis at the moment, we cannot forget about the U.S. shale production. And I believe that ultimately this is a business decision by Saudi Arabia, who is looking to price out its competitors from the market.
So, but in Iran, my sense was that Iranians felt like Saudi Arabia was trying to drive them out of the oil market by essentially driving prices so low that Iran couldn't be competitive in the markets. But you're saying that's not necessarily the case.
I think that's a feeling across the board, and you've also got to remember that Russia is backing Syria, and Saudi Arabia would surely backing Assad, sorry, and the Saudi Arabia would surely not be happy with that. But the America used to be a significant buyer of Saudi oil, and since they've increased shale production, they've become independent. So that's a major factor, and that's what's contributed to the glut as well. Now, saying that, last August, the former ambassador from Iran to the Emirates told me that as soon as the sanctions go, Russia, the United States, and Saudi Arabia will have to make way because they want their market share back. And so far, going by yesterday's statement from the oil minister, it looks like they'll be doing just that.
And Reinhard Mansour, we heard Alexander talking just a little bit about the conflict in Syria. One of the most effective forces against ISIS has been Kurdish fighters from northern Iraq. How have lower oil prices affected the Kurdish enclave in northern Iraq, which is providing so many of the security forces, at least the ones the U.S. backs, that are fighting against the Assad regime against ISIS?
Well, the Kurdistan regional government is in a complete and utter economic disaster. You know, the state hasn't been able to pay employees for several months, some saying as back as last April. And that sort of the story or the promise of the KRG when just a few years ago people were calling it the new Dubai or one of these emerging markets is being questioned at the moment. The KRG is trying desperately to try and find ways to accommodate. And just recently, Abadi agreed to help pay some of the salaries. And keep in mind, the Kurdistan regional government, most of the employees are state employees. So it's a bloated bureaucracy. And many of the people, citizens of that enclave, expect salaries from the state. So in any case, Abadi promised recently to give some of those salaries if the KRG, the condition was if the KRG stopped exporting oil independently. And so that sort of arrogance that the Kurdistan region of Iraq had in saying we can just export oil independently, that arrogance has dwindled, and now they're realizing that they actually may need to work with Baghdad at least the economic level.
And what about ISIS itself? How are people within areas of Iraq and Syria controlled by the Islamic State? How is this affecting them?
I mean, you know, it's really hard to tell, first of all, but there is a danger in all of this. If you look at, for example, Mosul, a city that's almost 2 years now under the occupation of the Islamic State, it's being able to entrench itself more and more. So the longer it lasts in these areas, the longer it becomes part of the structure there. We know that even though they were failing in state-building measures previously, it's really hard to tell how the people there will be able to survive and how the Islamic State will be able to continue building states if it's actually hurting from not being able to export its oil, which initially was a big part of its economic strategy to be able to sell oil on the black market.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week we look at how falling oil prices are bringing economic gloom to exporters in the Middle East. We're talking to Georgi Kanchev, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal based in London. From Beirut, Reinhard Mansour, a fellow with the Carnegie Institute for International Peace. And from Dubai, Alexander Cornwell, a reporter on oil for Gulf News. A reminder that if you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read our ongoing series of interviews with journalists in exile around the world and coverage of foreign affairs and press freedom issues. We're also on social media. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at GlobalJourn. Georgi Kanchev, I wanted to ask you about the U.S.'s role in this, because my understanding is that U.S. shale oil production is much costlier than oil production in Saudi Arabia. And so it almost seems like there is a bit of a game of chicken right now between some of these oil-producing countries in the Gulf and higher-cost producers such as the U.S. right now. Are some of these countries like Saudi Arabia going to be able to ride out low prices without facing major social instability until they can effectively drive higher cost producers out of the market?
What we shouldn't forget about the U.S. shale is that these producers, these oil drillers, have made quite significant advances in efficiency in the past few years. So when this whole oil price slump started, in 2014, people were talking about $70-$80 as a break-even price for shale. Then this price has fallen to $60-$50. Now people are saying that, you know, $30 oil, while it's not definitely not great for shale drillers, is still possible to, you know, maintain production. And we see it in numbers. I mean, U.S. Output has peaked last year at 9.7 million barrels a day, but it has been stable around 9.2. So in the end, we can see that production in the States hasn't fallen that much. On the other hand, in some other countries who are more reliant on oil, there depends really on the country. I mean, we have examples like Libya, for example, which needs more than $200 oil to balance its budget. whereas we have countries like Qatar, which needs less than 50. So it really depends on the country. But for all those producers who really rely on oil, it's gonna create some structural challenges, including the society. I mean, look at countries like even Venezuela, for example. Last night they hiked the gas prices by 6,000%. So this is an example of a country which has enjoyed almost free oil, free gas, gasoline for ages, and now they have to actually pay for it. So this is an example of how the cheap oil is hurting many, many producers.
And Alexander Cornwell, we heard at the top of the show about Oman's efforts to cope with falling oil prices, and the government's trying really to mute how much it is affecting young people who often go to work in government jobs there. How do you see that Saudi Arabia and other sort of wealthy Gulf nations are addressing this issue? Do they face the potential for renewed sort of Arab Spring-style protests if they're cutting jobs for young people?
We haven't really seen any mass cut in jobs yet in the Gulf. What we have seen from the region's two biggest economies, Saudi Arabia and UAE, is calls from the government from the top level for structural reform. We heard last month the Deputy Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, the son of the king of the country, say that they are considering privatizing or selling shares in part of Saudi Aramco, the state oil company. We're also hearing in the Emirates as well as in Saudi Arabia that they're seriously considering introducing VAT. Now, they've said that may not come online.
Sorry, VAT is the value-added tax then.
That's right.
And these are countries where people basically pay no taxes.
Exactly. At the moment, the Gulf states are income tax-free places to live, and that's how they attract many expatriate workers. However, we've got to keep in mind that there have been indirect taxes in this part of the world for many years. In Dubai, there's a road tax, there's municipal taxes. But these are significant changes, and they're definitely looking at how they can find new revenue sources, I guess, without having to resort to mass layoffs.
But if you raise taxes on people who are used to getting all these government services, healthcare for free, cushy jobs for their children, doesn't that change the nature of the relationship between the government and the people? And don't the people potentially come to demand more accountability from some of these monarchies?
That's a good question. And it's going to be a case of wait and see. When the Economist interviewed Mohammed bin Salman, they did ask him, does this not mean, is there taxation without representation? And his response was, there are no taxes, although that is a tax. So it is a case of wait and see. However, in Bahrain early this month, they announced plans to follow other Gulf states in increasing petrol prices. But that was a cabinet-level decision, and the parliament protested and refused to hold sessions because they thought that they weren't being treated as a legitimate parliament. So it is a tricky period of time, but so far the Gulf states are certainly balancing it at the moment.
And Reynaud Mansour, in Iraq, there's something like one quarter of the population is dependent on government jobs and government salaries that are essentially funded by oil revenues. So what does their economic troubles, what does that forebode for the relationship between the Iraqi state and its people?
Yeah, in a very similar story, that social contract where the citizens expect the state to provide salaries is being questioned at the moment. And what we're probably going to see in Iraq is another sort of protest. I mean, there is already a protest movement, but as the summer comes and as the state is still unable to pay these salaries, and with the hot weather and inability for electricity and the other issues that come with the low oil price, we'll probably see more and more protests in areas like Baghdad, Basra, Najaf, as well as in the north in Kurdistan. So what you are seeing throughout the country, notwithstanding sector, ethnicity, or religion, is a general protest movement against their governments, be it regional governments or the federal government, because of an inability of the state to provide for its citizens.
And Georgi Kanchev, when you look at some of the changes that are being instituted in various countries, you get a sense, is it the middle class that's being most affected? Is it the young? Is it the poor? Which demographics are sort of facing the brunt of these economic challenges?
I think that the elites, for sure, they they have ways to insulate themselves and protect themselves, but the rest will definitely get hit. And the example of Venezuela, this is a country which has been under pressure for a while, and its economy hasn't been growing much, but now, and has obviously suffered from super high inflation, and now this 6,000% hike in gas prices is a big worry for the population. The same goes for wealthier countries as well, where even though they have more fiscal buffers, it will definitely impact spending, government spending, and I think that the different classes in the population, they'll feel it in a different way. But I think young people, for example, getting few opportunities, and in Saudi Arabia, we've seen lots of young people who had the security and the vision that they're going to work in oil for their career. Now they're questioning that and looking for other jobs.
And Alexander Cornwell, if I could get you to look in your crystal ball a little bit, how do you see this dynamic changing in the Gulf over the next couple of years? Do you foresee that prices will stay fairly low and there will be this sort of continuing pressure on these governments?
Well, we've had the UAE energy minister at times say that oil price is going to stabilize. So far, it hasn't. But we've got to remember that despite the oil price, that Saudi Arabia and the UAE particularly, as well as other Gulf states, have hundreds of billions of dollars of cash reserves that can help prop up their economies, at least in the near term, and keep nationals employed. And we also need to remember that in the UAE and in Qatar, the nationals, the Qataris and the Emiratis, are a minority in their own countries, and that these are expat-reliant countries. Now, long-term, if the oil price does stay low, it is certainly going to put more pressure on these economies. We're going to see most likely more privatization of state assets as well as government services. How that impacts in the long term is in terms of the social contract between the nationals and the rulers. At the moment, it's a case of wait and see.
And it may also lead to more expatriate workers losing their jobs within these countries then, as the countries try to essentially Arabize their private sector then. Is that fair to say?
Of course, that's definitely a fair assessment. And we've also got to remember that the expats will be some of the probably most likely, like in Oman, will be some of the first to go. And we also got to remember that part of the thing that attracts expats to live in the Gulf is the tax-free salary. So if things were to change, once value-added tax comes into place, who knows how the expatriates will react, and maybe they'll vote with their feet.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Many thanks to Mayank Singh, Georgie Kanchev, Reynad Mansour, and Alexander Cornwell for coming on the program. Global Journalist Executive Producer is Josh Kranzberg. Our associate producers this week are Lakshna Mehta, Louise Hemmerly, Li Ying Kwan, and John Doty. Travis McMillan of RJI is our studio director. Pat Akers of KBIA is our audio engineer. Until next week, for all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure.